I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In the first news conference of his second term, President Bush was asked about his plans for Middle East peace. He began by saying that the roadmap to peace outlined over 2 years ago is still his best policy, that he's still in favor of a peaceful Palestinian state beside Israel, but he went on to make his case that bringing freedom, however that's done, is still the best policy.
If you do not believe people can be free and can self-govern, then all of a sudden the two-state solution in the Middle East becomes a moot point, invalid. If you're willing to condemn a group of people to a system of government that hasn't worked, then you'll never be able to achieve the peace. You cannot lead this world and our country to a better tomorrow unless you have a vision of a better tomorrow.
Bush's statement comes at a pivotal point in the Mideast. Not only does he have another year, 4 years to lead America himself, but Yasser Arafat lies mortally ill and Israel is pressing ahead with plans for a withdrawal of settlers from Gaza. So here's our question today. What kind of moment is this for the U.S. to alter its Mideast policy? Does the absence of Arafat mean that it's time to include Palestinians once again in discussions about the future of that land? Is President Bush well placed to make a change in policy? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to be hearing from a number of people this hour. First, I'd like to start with Sanad Sahelia. He is a journalist for Al-Quds Daily Newspaper. He's joining us live on the line from Ramallah. Hello, Sanad.
Hello, Dick. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for joining us. Tell me what people there are saying about Mr. Arafat today.
Yeah. Of course, first of all, they are sad, angry, and worried about Arafat, because he's the president, he's the historical president. But I can say, as the Palestinians now looking for them president's unknown condition, in the same time they are looking for also the unknown image for the future. They worried about what the future will bring for them after Arafat. Yes, we can say that there is a Palestinian institutions and procedures will take the Palestinians now through this moment. But on ground, the Palestinian cause is a very complicated case. So nobody can say what will happen. Nobody know what happened with Arafat now. Somebody says he's in a coma. Somebody says that his brain dead. But there is some people said that he's poisoned. So it's a very difficult situation.
Lots of rumors.
Yeah.
Are the people in Ramallah afraid of what will happen after Mr. Arafat, or are they thinking maybe life will be better?
No, they are afraid. It's a complicated case. Arafat is the historical president. Nobody knows what will happen now. In on ground, there is a lot of Palestinian parties. The Islamic movement is very strong in the West Bank and also in Gaza. Also Fatah, there is a lot of party inside Fatah. Someone with the military operations. Somebody he's not with it. So it's very difficult. After Arafat, nobody know what will happen after Arafat passed away.
Sanad, I want to thank you for being with us.
Bye.
Sanad Sahelia is a journalist with Al-Quds Daily Newspaper, joining us there on the line from Ramallah. Next, we're going to Senator George Mitchell. He is a former senator from Maine, served as special envoy to the Middle East in the Clinton administration, with a long history of involvement in international peacekeeping, first in Northern Ireland, most recently in 2001 as head of an international committee in the Mideast, and author of a widely hailed peace plan that bore his name. Senator Mitchell, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Dick.
Would you help us with your thoughts today on the stature of Yasser Arafat? I mean, on one hand, we have a man who's a hijacker, a revolutionary, many call him a terrorist. On the other hand, a man who was an honored guest at Camp David, winner of a Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, of course, that describes over a span of time and different perspectives. But to the Palestinians, for 40 years, he's the only leader they've known. He's the person responsible for placing their interests and concerns at the center of the international stage. So his legacy among Palestinians will, of course, be very different than, say, among Israelis or others. It'll be a very difficult and emotional time for the Palestinians. My hope is that they will recognize that their self-interest lies in a credible transition of leadership and to give a new leader the authority both to reach an agreement to bring this conflict to an end and to implement any agreement. But both very tough tasks.
I describe those two faces of Arafat because I wonder if in your own experience those two roles, warrior and peacemaker, won't be leaving young Palestinians with a pretty confused idea about what is the best road ahead.
Well, that would be the case, but of course images change over time. Not that there's any genuine comparison between them, but, you know, it's not too long ago that when Nelson Mandela tried to go to Britain, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher refused to let him in on the grounds that he was a terrorist. Attitudes change, people change, circumstances change. The problem, I think, has been that there has not been a strategy or, for that matter, tactics by the Palestinians that moves their interests forward. What they want is a state, an independent, sovereign state, geographically contiguous, economically viable. But the tactics they've been pursuing have not advanced them toward that state. In fact, it's achieved the opposite result. It's delayed and deferred it. On the other hand, the Israelis want security. They've got a state, but their citizens live in really unbearable fear and anxiety because of these horrific suicide attacks. So in my view, neither can attain its objective by denying to the other side its objective. The Palestinians are never going to get a state until the Israelis have some sense of security. I don't think the Israelis can have sustainable security until the Palestinian ambition of a state is realized. So I think an accommodation is really what's needed, and I think very much possible at this moment and in the near future.
Of course, one of the other circumstances that changed this week was the re-election of the Bush administration. What's the smartest move for the U.S. right now?
Well, to do something, to undertake an initiative, to make it clear that we're there, determined, persevering, we're going to stay till we get it done. You can't just announce a plan. The plan that I prepared was, in fact, accepted by both the Israelis and the Palestinians, by the Bush administration, by the UN, by everybody. But then nothing happened. Peace plans are hard to get. They're much harder to implement. They're not self-executing. They don't take effect by themselves. It's really much harder to get people to do something than to say they'll do something. And what has been lacking has been an intense, sustained effort by the United States government. And there's no other entity on earth that can do it. There's no other government, no other private party, no individual, no one but the U.S. government who has the capacity to create the context in which this conflict can be brought to an end. And yet I do believe it's possible. I think there is a tremendous opening now with the re-election of the president, the transition to new leadership among the Palestinians, and the Israelis pursuing the plan of disengagement that they've been following now, pursuing for some months.
I wonder if you look back to your own proposals for peace, whether or not the basics still apply. I ask you the question because when this is proposed to President Bush, he talks about a pre-9/11 mindset and a post-9/11 mindset. But if we look at the bullet points of your plan, it's an immediate and unconditional cessation of violence, cooperation between the government of Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and a rebuilding of confidence. Is that doable today?
Yes, it is. In fact, our plan, as I said, was accepted by everyone and then nothing happened, and was largely incorporated into the roadmap, which was the plan presented by the so-called quartet, the United States, the European Union, the UN, and Russia, a year or so later, and which is still on the table, that the president says is still his plan. Now, the roadmap went further than our plan. Our plan was designed to get them into negotiations. The roadmap prescribed a result of negotiations. But there have been numerous plans. They all say essentially the same thing. The real tragedy of the Middle East, the terrible tragedy about so many people dying, so much death and destruction, is that just about everyone knows approximately how it's going to end. The outlines of a settlement are clear. They came very close in 2000. There was the discussions at Camp David, and then they had follow-up discussions at a small town called Taba. Mm-hmm. They're very close. And when you talk to them privately, government officials and leading private citizens, it's sort of a recognition about where the possibilities of compromise are. That's what makes each death so terribly tragic.
And if it is then just the matter of a change of will, does that have to begin in Washington?
It cannot occur without Washington's participation, active leadership, but it can't be done by Washington unilaterally. It involves the two sides. There is a desire on both sides, despite the horrific violence that has occurred over the last 4 years, despite the thousands of people killed on both sides, the enormous destruction. I mean, the Palestinian economy has been literally destroyed, and Israel's economy has suffered very badly as a result of all of this conflict. Despite all of that, a majority on both sides still believes that the right result is a two-state solution and the political process needed to bring it about. What has happened is the complete loss of any faith in the other side's intentions to achieve that result. So you have the irony that they largely agree on approximately what the result should be, but they disagree on each other's intentions. That is, the mutual mistrust is total. The culture of peace, which was so carefully nourished for a decade, has been shattered and replaced by a resignation, a concept of the inevitability of conflict, and a complete mistrust of the other side. That's what's needed, and only the United States can create the context in which that attitude can be restored. That is the attitude of trying to get this done.
Senator Mitchell, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dick.
Senator George Mitchell was a special envoy to the Middle East during the Clinton administration and author of The Mitchell Plan. Our number, if you'd like to join us, 1-800-423-8255. We'll be taking a break in just a moment, but I do want to bring in the woman who will be helping us through the balance of the hour. Judith Kipper is joining us now. She is director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations and has been here before. Judith, it's nice to have you back.
Thank you. Always good to be with you.
Senator Mitchell ended by saying there was this lack of trust. Is that, in your view as well, the one thing that needs to be worked on by all sides here?
Yes, I think that not only is there a complete lack of trust between Israelis and Palestinians, but each side sees themselves as the key victim, the one who has suffered the most. And both sides are deeply traumatized, so they're no longer able to negotiate with each other. A third party really has to step in a very firm way to help them to get to the resolution that Senator Mitchell talked about, which in fact is accepted by a vast majority of both Israelis and Palestinians. And that's the role of the United States.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. It is a week in which a number of different changing circumstances are coming together. There is the mortal illness of Yasser Arafat, now seen as almost certain that he will not return to his leadership of the Palestinian Authority, the Israeli government decision to press ahead with its removal of settlers from the Gaza Strip, and a new administration a reconfirmed administration in Washington, with President Bush saying that freedom and peace are near the top of his agenda as well when it comes to the Middle East. So what's it going to take? Who has to make the first move? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour, Judith Kipper, director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're taking a look at this week in the Mideast with the re-election of President Bush, the imminent death of Yasser Arafat, something that is still being debated in Paris and in the Mideast. We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. And Judith, you knew Yasser Arafat quite well. You've met him a number of times. I'm wondering how much his absence from the scene will change the picture there in the Mideast.
Yasser Arafat was the symbol of Palestinian national aspirations, the Palestinian flag, so to speak. And as Senator Mitchell said, he was the only leader that they've known for some four decades. So he is a very important symbolic figure. And he ruled with an iron hand. He was just like all the other autocratic Arab leaders. He ruled with the tools at his disposal, money, coercion, sometimes terrorism, manipulation. And certainly that did not help to develop a peaceful, modern leadership among the Palestinians, or those who were wanted to negotiate were put in the background. He will be missed, but as a symbol, but he will not be missed as a leader. The conditions in the West Bank and Gaza are so horrific. People are so aware of the corruption in the Palestinian Authority and that he allowed to happen, that the domestic issues for the Palestinians, which they hold Yasser Arafat responsible for, are issues that are very important to the average Palestinian because their economic and social conditions are so bad. But they are frightened. It's a major transition. There will be a huge amount of emotion, and a lot of the deficits of Yasser Arafat are not going to be recognized right away. He'll be a hero for a while, mm-hmm. and then I think that there will be a settling down and almost a sense of relief that they can now move on with their future. And they've already built a consensus leadership, which is quite remarkable what's happened in the last 7 or 8 days since he was taken ill and taken to Paris. And I believe that this is a very positive step, and there will be a fair degree of wheeling and dealing among the various groups. I believe it can and will lead to elections in some time.
All right. Let's move to Serge Schmemann, who's joining us now on the line from Paris, where he's working as editorial page editor for the International Herald Tribune. Serge was a former bureau chief in Jerusalem for the New York Times, won a Pulitzer Prize for international reporting. Serge, nice to hear from you.
Good to hear you, Dick.
Tell me what you're anticipating here. Are you expecting a messy, violent period after the death of Arafat? Do you think that the moves that the Palestinian Authority are putting into place now can do anything to prevent that?
Well, I think Judith is right. I think they've done a good job of preparing an interim administration. There are people in place, Abu Ala, Abu Mazen, the head of the Legislative Council. These are people who have some authority. They're known, and they will be in place. I gather that right now Abu Ala is talking to Hamas and others down in Gaza. And I think they will all try to ensure a period of peace and the appearance of stability. But obviously, when a man of this stature passes from the scene, there will be a huge power struggle. It's very much in Hamas's interest right now to make a move, to make it appear that they are the ones responsible for the Israelis pulling out of Gaza. Mm-hmm. There will be a power struggle within Fatah. And ultimately, I think all that can, the only event that could give the next leader any credibility would be elections. So the real task of this interim administration, I think, will be to prepare the Palestinians for an election, which would give a leader some form of credibility. That's what I think we should be watching for. And that's where the United States and Israel could probably help.
It's certainly something, a point that is being made by a lot of observers, this urgency of getting two elections. It's something we'll stay with on the program. I want to begin including our callers in the conversation. We're going to go first to Raleigh, North Carolina. Sam's on the line. Hi, Sam.
Hey.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I've been thinking about this for a long time, probably 20 years, before 9/11 even occurred. My greatest fear was the Muslim question or problem, and Palestine being the heart of the problem. Seems like if we were to go to the heart of the matter and this country to have devoted its resources to Palestine, building a Palestine, providing this incredible economic infrastructure program and just embracing them, you know, spending the $200 billion that we spent on Iraq and all of our, you know, resources rather than going there, to have started with Palestine, embrace Palestine, and bring the two children into the room and say, okay, we're gonna pour all of this money and resource and take care of the problem once and for all, and then go from there and let this economic seed just radiate throughout the Middle East.
Judith Kipper, would it have made a difference if the United States had put the time and resources into continuing its work with the Middle East instead of diverting its attention to Iraq, or would we still have that the conflict that we're seeing there?
I think it would have made a tremendous difference. The caller, there's real wisdom in some of the things the caller has said. The United States is the only party they turn to in seeking peace. We know what the solution is. Everybody knows what it is in the framework. We can call it the Clinton Plan, TABA, the Geneva Initiative. The United States has to write a document that includes all of what the Palestinians and Israelis have agreed to previously, expand that, and get the support of the quartet, being Russia, the United Nations, the Europeans, the Arab countries, and the vast majority of Israelis and Palestinians, and move forward with very little possibility to escape from the American plan, because it's supported by Israelis and Palestinians, and they themselves negotiated it. So they can make some minor changes, negotiate around the edges, mm-hmm. but it has to come from the outside.
All right. And Serge, let me hear from you on this and place us where we are today and looking ahead. Is this an opportunity for the administration?
It obviously is an opportunity. The whole mantra in recent weeks and months has been that there is no Palestinian negotiating partner so long as Arafat is alive, so long as he's sitting there, so long as he's in charge. Well, he's gone. There are people who will take charge. There are people who can be negotiated with. And now, if the process doesn't begin now, if the United States does not get involved, it will really be missing a major opportunity. And about the point the caller made about pouring resources, to me, one of the tragic aspects of this entire conflict is that the Palestinians have the resources. There is a tremendous amount of money that came flowing into Gaza, into the West Bank after the Oslo Accords. There are large, wealthy Palestinian communities outside. So the resources are there. What it needs is the stability and the promised state. And now there really is an opportunity, yes.
All right, to Louisville, Kentucky next. Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff. What are you thinking?
Well, I agree with what Sam had said in terms of the resources that are needed there. I was in the Middle East in the 90s when the Oslo Accords were implemented. And one of the things that at the time, the amount of resources that were pledged by the international community relative to what was required according to the independent studies was like 1/100th the amount. And at the time, the unemployment rate was over 70% in Palestine. It's now, I believe, in the 90s. I could be wrong on both those figures, but and we had rioting in the streets in 69 when we got to 13% unemployment. So, I mean,
so what are you saying the administration ought to be doing at this moment then, Jeff?
I think they need to, in parallel with whatever political solutions are taking place, we need to implement economic solutions, infrastructure programs, so that, and there may be a lot of private resources there, but the issue is, without the infrastructure and the plans to put the infrastructure in place, private individuals won't spend money. Private corporations won't spend a lot of money. So we have to put those kind of plans in place in parallel. And
let me, if I can, Jeff, take this and turn it to Judith, because you talked a little bit earlier, Judith, about the just basic living conditions for Palestinians and how much that's a matter that either has to be addressed by a new Palestinian leadership or Europeans or Americans or the extent to which that has to be changed before this whole conversation about peace takes on real momentum again.
I think many things have to be addressed at the same time. First and foremost, the interim leadership based on some kind of consensus leading to elections. At the same time, I suspect the once Arafat is actually gone, that the interim leadership will pay attention to economic issues and try to get Palestinians back to work, get some money into the hands of Palestinians, give contracts to them, and create employment and a little mini economic boom to give people some relief. A lot of that is going to depend on whether the Israelis, providing there is quiet in the West Bank, whether the Israelis will be willing to back off, to get away from the cities, to dismantle some of the checkpoints so the Palestinians can move freely within the West Bank and within Gaza. But the economic question has become a primary question because there is now malnutrition. There is profound psychological trauma among children and adults in the West Bank and Gaza. And these issues now have to be addressed by a more stable, thoughtful interim government and eventually by an elected and legitimate government of the Palestinians.
And Serge, tell me from your perspective how likely it is that you're going to have Western governments making those kinds of commitments. And we've got the U.S. so overextended with the war in Iraq. You're living in Europe now. What's the perspective from Paris?
I think European governments would be prepared again to reenter and to help. They've been in there before. I think they're looking for a role. I think with the reelection of George Bush, there is a longing here to get involved in some kind of joint effort somewhere, and the Middle East is as good a place as any to start. So I suspect there would be help. It really requires right now courage and action by the Bush administration, because right now within the in the Palestinian leadership, there is a lot of confusion. They'll be watching Israel and what Sharon might do, how he will react. Hamas is watching for its opportunity. If right now the United States could step up very strongly and say, the moment has come, let's get to work, that would be something everybody could rally around. It would be a very, very powerful signal, but it has to be done seriously and with consistency. Somebody has to be appointed who would be respected by both sides. But at this moment, I think that's where everybody will be looking.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Lexington, Massachusetts. Peter's on the line. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I have 2 points. Hmm. One is that since 73, the Muslim oil states have received between $4 and $6 trillion through an accident of geology. And it would seem to me that they could be asked to supply some money for things other than rewarding suicide bombers. Why it is the American role to supply money either to the Palestinian Arabs or, for that matter, in Iraq to rebuild that that country seems to me rather curious, rather strange. And I just don't think most people want to be in the, you know, it is not at all clear that rebuilding or building these countries is the best way to deal with a worldwide jihad.
Okay, Peter, let me take that. I know you had two, but it's a good place to start. Judith, we've talked about the need for political leadership from the West, from the United States, but why can't the money for this kind of reconstruction come from the Gulf?
I think probably a lot of it can, but it's not going to come all by itself. It's going to come only when the United States steps forward and says, this is it, kids, this conflict is going to be resolved, and mobilizes not only the quartet, but the Arab countries and other countries in the world to assist in this process. I do believe that the Arabs, especially with $50 a barrel oil, that they would be willing to contribute, but not in a vacuum, not in the absence of a negotiation that is really clearly committed to ending the conflict permanently once and for all, because step by step is over. All of the parties, including the United States, with the step-by-step process, including the Mitchell Plan, have allowed a single 12-year-old boy with the dynamite belt around his waist to interrupt negotiations. So the extremists have been setting the agenda. And I would just say for the callers, worldwide jihad, I think, is unfortunate. There is no worldwide jihad. 1.2 billion Muslims in the world, 99.99% of them are peaceful, looking for prosperity, hardworking, family values, living within their cultural and ethnic traditions. But there are a few extremists, and they are wreaking havoc in many, many places, and we have to deal with those extremists as criminals and find them and stop the money. But we also have to look at root causes, and part of the root cause for the extremism in the Palestinian territories is the lack of the resolution of the conflict and the truly desperate economic situation that exists there at this time.
Okay, Serge, you've covered enough meetings of the Arab League in your time. I understand what you're saying about, you know, basically bringing the parties together, but it does seem to me that the Arab leadership and the Arab resources have been lacking, even when those ultimatums have been delivered by presidents like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton.
Well, certainly they can do more. They should do more. And certainly there is the money there to do all these things. But I think the issue right now is not only money. The money follows the political leadership. Right now there has to be a sense that there is something worth investing in, that there is some process for which you can demand money from the Arabs and from all the other sources. And that's where really the focus should be, on getting a political commitment, on showing a very visible and immediate political commitment to some kind of process. The money then will follow, and demanding it from the Arabs, especially from the wealthy Arab nations, will certainly be fair enough.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Your chance to join our conversation about this moment in the Middle East. What kind of a moment is it for the United States to reassess its Mideast policy? With Arafat on his deathbed, Israel pushing ahead in its unilateral fashion in removing settlers from the Gaza Strip. President Bush saying, not in so many words, but that the push to bring freedom to people in Iraq remains a principal part of his Mideast policy, that bringing that kind of freedom can only be seen as something that people throughout the region could then aspire to. Is that working? Does the United States need to get more directly involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection on our hour talking about the moment for the United States to alter its Mideast policy and whether or not the absence of Arafat means it's time to include Palestinians again in discussions about the future of that land. They have been considered not partners for peace by both the United States and Israel now for more than the past 2 years. Serge Maimon is with us. He's editorial page editor for the International Herald Tribune, and Judith Kipper, director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations. Judith, I understand you have to leave shortly. I wanted to just give you one chance for a final reflection, and that is that I think you could make a pretty strong argument that perhaps the moment for international involvement to bring peace to the Middle East may in fact be past, that the ill will that now exists between Hamas and Fatah and Islamic Jihad means that there's going to be such a vacuum that violence in fact is going to come before anybody can step in and do anything constructive.
I would argue almost the opposite. I think that the consensus building in the interim leadership that we've seen in the last 7-8 days is a very positive and a really quite extraordinary step by the Palestinians. I believe that Abu Mazen and Abu Ala can manage to keep that consensus together while there's some wheeling and dealing. There may be sporadic violence. There may be some, hopefully not, assassination attempts. But I do believe the Palestinians are so exhausted, so traumatized, that as long as people are talking and there's a dialogue and they are all at the table, that they will be able to move forward and get to elections. What's important is for the outside parties not to interfere. they need to have this process go on without outside parties, including the Arabs. The Arabs need to be supportive with money and when the time comes with political support. But for the time being, they really need to be left alone until they can get their internal house in order. And what's going to be remarkable, in my view, is that it is the Palestinians themselves that are going to get to the ceasefire. It is this consensus building that will convince Hamas to stop the acts. And I think that that will be a huge accomplishment and enable them to move forward to create a new, modern, elected, and eventually democratic leadership.
Does it make any difference that Colin Powell remains Secretary of State in the United States?
For the United States, obviously, who is Secretary of State is of enormous importance. I don't think it depends on an individual. It depends very much on having someone who understands how the world works, who has patience, who understands diplomacy, and who can treat others within their cultural context with respect and protect the interests of the United States in a peaceful way. And that's a very tall order. Colin Powell certainly is someone who has all those qualifications, but he's not the only one.
Judith, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Judith is director of the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK, and we're going next to Newton, Massachusetts. Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Yes, hi. I'm feel positive that Arafat's death will be positive for the Middle East. People forget that he was really a brutal dictator. It removes one more sort of Arab dictator from the Middle East. He ruled with an iron fist through intimidation and murder. People forget how much Palestinian blood Arafat had on his hands. And he also ruled through a culture of intimidation and hatred against Israel and Jews, and he fostered this terrible hatred amongst the Palestinian youth. And perhaps now that he's gone, the situation will change, a new leadership will emerge, and I think that the United States and the rest of the world, what we should be doing is providing as much support to Israel in its fight against the terrorists so that the new leadership can emerge, because Israel is the only power in the region that has the physical capability of eliminating the terrorists, and we need to be solidly behind them.
So the U.S. should not, in fact, be providing equal support backing to the Palestinians and to the Israelis, but concentrate its resources on aiding Israel?
I think it's a two-step process. I think initially it's supporting Israel in eliminating terror, because only when, and then when that happens, supporting a new moderate Palestinian leadership that can emerge from beneath that.
Serge, can it work that way?
I think this notion that terror can be eliminated, if only, you know, that it is some kind of concrete item that you can get rid of, is simply not so. It's terror is a response to a great degree to something that is going on. It's a weapon. It's a terrible means, but it is a means towards an end. And certainly the United States has shown total support for Israel in fighting terrorism. But I think at this stage, what we're looking at is such an important transition on the Palestinian side that a huge amount of resources and effort should go there. And, Arafat, all these things that the gentleman described are true. He was all these things. He was more, as we've said before, he was the only leader they've ever known. And I think right now there is an enormous vacuum on the Palestinian side. And one of the tasks is to find a successor who would have the legitimacy and at least some of the charisma to be capable of making the kind of extraordinarily difficult decisions that a Palestinian leader will have to be making.
Would the Palestinians expect that new leader, whoever he is, also to have some of the strong arm nature of leaders who have already risen? I'm thinking of people like the former security chief in Gaza, Mohammed Dahlan, and Jibril Rajab, who holds the same job in the West Bank. They, by being tough guys in their areas or in the respect of people, a little bit unlike someone like Mahmoud Abbas, who's a former Palestinian prime minister. What are people looking for?
Well, there are several characteristics the next leader will require, and not all of them are beneficial or pleasant for Israelis or for Americans. I think what the leader will have to have shown that he can stand up to Israelis and to Americans. That is one of the criteria for being a national leader. Somebody like Marwan Barghouti, for example, who's currently sitting in an Israeli jail, is a man who has tremendous standing among his people, and at least before the trial and before the things he was accused of, mm-hmm. was regarded as a very moderate man. Dahlan, whom you mentioned in Gaza, speaks Hebrew, is very capable of dealing with Israelis, but does have a reputation for being tough. So yes, the next Palestinian leader will have to show that he is tough, and not only with his own people, more to the point, he'll have to show that he can be tough with Israelis and with the Americans. That is one of the factors that I think the Americans and the Israelis will have to accept to some degree, that the man who's chosen will not just be somebody who will agree to whatever they put before him.
Okay, to Burlington, Vermont next, and Dan's on the line. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
It seems as if true diplomacy really needs to happen at some point, whether it's after the restructuring and a new leader's put in place. And I was just curious if what names would be out there for the United States to send over for this. And I was thinking if Bill Clinton could be a possibility to really represent some true diplomacy, to throw some real cards on the table and actually see what we can do at this point. Possibly the current administration has lost some credibility, and I was wondering if maybe going outside of the administration would be a more effective tool.
There are questions, Serge, here in the U.S. about the ability or the willingness of the new Bush administration to reach out and demonstrate a sort of bipartisanship. Would the use of Clinton in a role like that be? What do you think?
Well, Clinton is enormously popular in the region, both on the Israeli side, perhaps especially on the Israeli side, and on the Palestinian side. I find it difficult to imagine the Bush administration recruiting him for this task, but he is a man with considerable stature out there. Senator Mitchell, who was in this program earlier, also has strong standing. But then so does Secretary Powell. I think a lot depends on whether he will remain or who is appointed to succeed him. There are people who would be trusted. But above all, I think what this requires is a sign from this administration that it really has the political courage to do what is necessary to roll back the violence and to urge both sides to resume negotiations. The sign has to really come from the president himself. And the person he appoints will be an important part of that sign, but it has to be something the president says and does.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. Next to Watertown, Massachusetts, and John's with us. Hi, John.
Hello.
So tell me what you're thinking.
I've been listening to the debate with great interest, but a number of things always seem to be very inconsistent to me. We talk of extremists quite often, and we automatically seem to assume that these are Palestinian extremists. Yet the land occupied by the Palestinians is, in fact, occupied territory, occupied by the Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless,
John, I'm going to step in if you don't mind. There's a dinging there that's making it a little bit difficult to stay with you. But the point, if I'm not mistaken here, Serge, is that you know the conversation has focused on the use of brutal tactics and force on the Palestinian side, and John is saying that there has been a considerable amount of that on the Israeli side as well. It kind of brings us back to the mediator role, I guess.
It does indeed. I think, you know, we've been focusing on the Palestinian side largely because that is where the major change is anticipated any minute now with Arafat's illness. But certainly one of the functions of the administration of the United States will be to use its enormous influence on Israel, on Prime Minister Sharon, to persuade them to cease some of the violence that we've seen, to persuade them to help them go ahead with a plan to withdraw settlements from Gaza. and to persuade them to show patience during the transition and not to undermine whatever transition is taking place, and to start some sort of process with whatever leadership comes to power. So, yes, there certainly is a lot of work to be done on the Israeli side itself, and we're focusing on the Palestinian side largely because that's where the focus is at this moment.
And what is, though, the likelihood that the Bush administration is going to be a little bit hamstrung by its support from Christian fundamentalists in this country who have been very explicit in expressing their support for Israel, saying that's where America's allegiance lies here? Is that going to make it difficult for President Bush?
It will, and that is where this administration and any administration has to show political courage and political wisdom. There are ways to build consensus, or at least to build support for what has to be done. It has to be explained. But the fact is, this administration was the one that came up with the roadmap. The roadmap still exists. This administration has pledged support for a two-state solution. So it is already on record seeking all the things that have to be achieved. So it doesn't have to really change course. It simply has to start doing something.
And does that come directly and specifically from Washington, or does that also come with Washington working in concert with Europeans? That's a kind of a wobbly relationship right now with the re-election of President Bush, and obviously that's going to work itself out at some level. But is it Washington alone, or is it the Western world?
I think in this, to me it seems that this is where a major part of the opportunity lies. There has been a tremendous transatlantic rift, and it has to be healed. It's very difficult to start with Iraq, but it has to start somewhere. And perhaps finding common ground on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one place where the Bush administration could start rebuilding bridges with the Europeans. I think this is something where the Europeans would be willing to join the administration. They would be willing to make it a showcase of possible collaboration. It could be done through NATO, through the EU, through any number of agencies. But I do think that Europe is one of the places where the United States at this time would find considerable support, simply in large part in order to heal the rift that has occurred over the last few years.
Serge, nice to hear from you again. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you very much.
Serge Maimon is editorial page editor for the International Herald Tribune, joining us there on the line from Paris. Earlier in the program, we also talked with Senator George Mitchell, who was special envoy to the Middle East during the Clinton administration, Judith Kipper, who directs the Middle East Forum at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Sanad Sahelia, who is a journalist with Al-Quds Daily Newspaper based in Ramallah. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.